Okay, so what did you think of David's talk?
I thought he was pretty good. He was real animated, I thought.
Oh yeah? Yeah. And did you learn anything?
Yeah, he explained a lot of stuff about the WinFX and the Biz talk that really made a lot of sense to me then.
I thought he was very informative. He was a very good speaker.
Okay, and what did he talk about that impressed you?
I like the way he boiled down the new components of WinFX into something that most of us could take away and apply back at home. That was about the best speaker we've had so far here.
I liked it a lot. It was really good. He's a very good speaker.
Did you learn something new?
Oh, most definitely. I went into it not knowing very much about Windows, the workflow portion of it, and the biz, like really what BizTalk was, and came away knowing a lot more about that kind of stuff.
And that's why we do what we do here at ArcCast. Yeah, I'm your host, Ron Jacobs, coming to you from VS Live San Francisco, where I have been just chatting up with many, many of the speakers here, learning a great deal about all kinds of interesting things. And today, we have the privilege of being joined by the David that they were talking about, David Chappell. David was delivering his keynote address this morning, and I snagged him and said, "Hey, David, let's do an ArcCast episode." And he graciously agreed to do so. And I think you're going to enjoy this. David is a really, really smart guy and easy to listen to. So let's give it up for David Chappell. And David, welcome to ArcCast.
Thanks, Ron. It's a pleasure to be here.
I have to tell you, I'm a little jealous because I've never got to do a keynote. I've been waiting and waiting. Hopefully one day I will ascend to the stage of keynote. But I've never gotten there yet. How did you get there?
I'm sure you're going to get there, Ron. Yeah. I don't know the answer to that question, really. I just give talks, and eventually I wind up doing talks like this. I think a big difference is that a lot of people who give talks have a real job. I don't really have a real job, but this is the heart of what I do, is speaking and writing. So I think I'm just more focused on it in some ways than most people are who do this kind of thing.
Okay. Well, I guess, you know, and we've seen each other at many events around the world over the years. I think I first met you at a event in Europe, if I remember right. It was quite some time ago because I got you confused with, I'm not going to remember his name. Well, I was on the Complus team, and it's on the tip of my tongue. He's the guy that does Rolling Thunder. That wrote the book David Platt. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right. And so I got you confused with David Platt because I was talking about how much I liked his book about Complus, and you said, "That's a nice book, but I didn't write it."
Well, that's right, and I'm honored because Dave Platt is a good guy. He's a good guy. And now, of course, people routinely confuse me with the David Chappell who works for Sonic Software. I began my keynote this morning by introducing him. He was in the front row of the audience, just to make clear to the audience that we are, in fact, two separate people.
and that is very confusing on many occasions, I'm quite sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, it is an interesting experience sometime to go Google on the web, or obviously, actually, as a Microsoft employee, I would never do that. I would use MSN search.
The verb Google is not in your vocabulary.
But I searched for my name on the web, you know, to see who else is out there. And over the years, I have been contacted by many other folks named Ron Jacobs because mm-hmm. I own ronjacobs.com. Mm-hmm. And it's quite interesting to see what comes up.
I own davidchappell.com, and I get email for Dave Chappelle, the TV comedian.
Uh-huh.
And I got to tell you, I routinely get suggestions for shows and skits on the show.
Uh-huh.
I do not think Dave Chappelle has the world's most intelligent audience based on the email I get, but I could be wrong. It's frightening.
Well, okay, so in today's keynote, you were talking about building a modern software application, and I was intrigued by that title. What do you think makes up a modern software application?
Well, first of all, constrain the discussion to where we are, VS Live. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about Windows development specifically. And so I think that what it means to be modern is to be using those technologies and those approaches that reflect, A, the latest in what Windows has to offer, and B, that address the real problems of supporting business processes. One of the big themes of my talk this morning was that we as software developers would like to think that we are artists. And sometimes we are, but a lot of the time we are there to help somebody make their business processes better in some way. And so we can use new technologies to make that happen. My examples this morning were primarily Windows Communication Foundation and Windows Workflow Foundation. So to answer your question succinctly, I would say that in the Windows world going forward, building modern applications is going to mean certainly building service-oriented applications, and where it makes sense, building applications that are workflow-driven as well.
So this wave of stuff that's coming with WinFX and BizTalk Server 2006 are certainly enablers for this, but this is a trend that's been coming a long time, right?
Oh, absolutely. The idea of service orientation has been here for who knows how long. But really, it's become mainstream now because finally all the vendors, after decades of fighting about it, have agreed on web services, have agreed on SOAP. It's like the agreement on TCP that happened 10 years ago. That gave us the Internet. This agreement is giving us this enormous industry-wide shift towards service orientation.
You know, it's just too bad we couldn't have agreed on this 10 years ago, and we'd have been a lot further down the road.
You know, I've spent almost my whole career working in app-to-app communication, literally 20 years, and I have worked on many preceding technologies like DCERPC and CORBA and DCOM. I have been waiting my whole life, really, for this to happen. I can die happy.
And I can see it. Your face is just glowing as you talk about this wonderful moment in history.
Yeah, we're lucky to be alive right now.
We'll tell our grandchildren, I was there. Well, so what's the as you've been exploring Windows Communication Foundation, what do you think makes it so much better than anything we've had before?
Well, it's just consistent. Rather than having diverse choices and forcing developers to choose the one that best fit what they were trying to do, whether it's ASMX or .NET Remoting or Enterprise Services or MSMQ, now you can do all those things from one coherent foundation. And that makes perfect sense. You could argue that Microsoft should have done this years ago. At the same time, it's fair to say the Java world also saw the distributed computing space as comprising these distinct problems, because they also have discrete technologies in all the same areas. They have one that's like remoting, they have one that's like enterprise services, they have one that's like MSMQ, one that's like ASMX. So that view of the world as being discrete and being different enough to warrant different technologies was pervasive in both .NET and Java. Microsoft, with WCF, has now gotten away from that and said, no, services are where we're going. A consistent platform is the way to do it. Hence WCF.
And, you know, the thing that strikes me about it is, and having watched this thing evolve over the, you know, from the inside of Microsoft, is how amazing they did of building a very simple programming model. I mean, it's not complicated rocket science stuff. It's pretty easy to put this together.
Fair statement. It's easy and it's simple if you're doing fairly straightforward stuff. When you start doing more complex stuff, asynchronous, multi-threaded communication, well, okay. The thing about complexity, I think Martin Fowler said this, you can run, but you can't hide. And so some of those things just become inherently complex. But to do basic stuff is straightforward, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, in the companies that you deal with, here's the thing. I get a lot of people saying, well, this sounds interesting, but how real is this? Is this move to service-oriented architecture? Are people really being successful doing it, and or is this just another hype phase?
Man, this is a great question, and it's something I think about literally every day. I think it's useful to differentiate two separate things here. One of them is the very technical idea that I talked about in my keynote this morning and that we have implicitly been discussing so far in our conversation, which is that you build new applications and they communicate for Windows using WCF, not using remoting or something else. Now, that is a slam dunk. That is where we are going. I feel utterly confident in saying that because Microsoft pushes us in that direction. It's an improvement. They tell us to do it. Why wouldn't we do it? Okay. Mm-hmm. That aspect of service orientation is absolutely the future for Windows developers. But when we talk about SOA, service-oriented architecture, there's a range of things people mean by that. If all they mean is building apps on WCF, then I think, as I said, it's a slam dunk. It's going to happen. Most often, though, in my experience, by the term SOA, people typically have a more enterprise-oriented view. And so they mean things like especially extensive reuse of services or at least being able to repurpose existing services for better agility, I guess is the buzzword. That aspect of SOA, I personally am becoming a little bit more skeptical about because I've talked to so many people in so many organizations the last 2 years who are trying to do this. And some of them get value, but an awful lot of them find that the organizational challenges to that kind of enterprise-wide reuse are overwhelming. The technology with services has gotten much better, much easier, but the fundamental problems to deriving that substantial business value are not technical. They're human. They're organizational. They're daunting.
You know, that's a very interesting observation because I think it may explain why none of the revolutions that we previously had, you know, object orientation was going to save the world and we were all going to reuse. And in practice, we looked and we found that there wasn't a lot of reuse going on. There was maybe a little bit here and there. Certainly, it was an improvement. It enabled, even the idea of something like the .NET framework is a very substantial advance over the old C runtime libraries and things that we had years ago. But organizations had a very, very hard time achieving reuse for not technical reasons, but people reasons. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't trust those guys, and I don't know what they did on the inside of that framework, and I want to rather build my own. And we are going to face the same obstacles here.
Absolutely. We do face the same obstacles. In some ways, they're worse. In some ways, they're better. But in some ways, they're worse. They're better in that when I was reusing objects, I would use your code. And so I could always rewrite it if I wanted to. With reusing services exposed by an application, for well-defined services, well-designed and well-defined services, the service exposes data as well. And in a well-run organization, that service provides the only way to get to that critical corporate data. In those scenarios, you can mandate reuse. You can say to people, you want that data, you must call this service. I like that model. So from that point of view, it's easier. It is also harder in some ways, though, because with object reuse, I could take your code and simply use your code, independent of you. With service reuse, you've got an app. I'm using your app. Well, first of all, why should you let me use your app? You're some part of my organization. There's some manager who owns and pays for that app, the CPU cycles, the storage. Why in the world should this manager let me, elsewhere in the company, build an app that uses his app? What's in it for him? That's a compelling problem that I've run across in many organizations. So the level of reuse implied by services can be better in some ways. You can force it by tying it to unique access to corporate data. It can be worse in other ways, in that it requires a degree of integration and sharing across business units that's even greater than what objects purported to give us.
That's very insightful because, recently I recorded an episode of our cast with Rick Merrifield from Microsoft, who's running a program we have called Motion. I don't know if you've heard about Motion.
You bet, yeah.
Yeah, so it's a very interesting program because it's sort of breaking new ground for Microsoft in that we've, typically not done what a lot of people might call business consulting. It's IT / business consulting anyway, in that looking at organizations and trying to understand their business processes from the business point of view. And he was telling me a story about an organization that had many different divisions, and they had the feeling that these divisions were duplicating a lot of work and that they weren't achieving the economies of scale that they wanted to achieve because these business units weren't
didn't understand enough about their own processes to be able to identify the duplicate work that was being done. And if you could get through and identify the opportunities for the business to drive economies of scale, lower costs, and improve efficiencies from the business perspective, and had the support of the you know, executives driving this down, then the technology enabling is relatively easy if you could understand it from that perspective.
Mm-hmm. True. In my experience, however, two things. One is that it's very difficult for IT guys to go to the business and say, I'm going to help you make your business processes better. The IT guys come in with, in many organizations, approximately zero credibility. And so it just doesn't work. Second, you'd mentioned having executive support. In my experience, if you have top business management support for a move to SOA in this more enterprise-oriented sense, not just the sense of using WCF, building your apps in that style, but the enterprise sharing that SOA ought to imply, if you have business top-down support, your job is much easier. And yet, in my experience, getting that support is essentially impossible in at least 90% of organizations. And the reason, again, is that IT just lacks credibility. IT cannot go to the business and say, give us $5 million. We'll SOA the world and come back with substantial ROI in 3 years. It doesn't work.
I'd hate to be in on that conversation. Yeah. Well, you know,
it's a very short conversation.
Yeah. Maybe that's why it makes sense to bring in, somebody like Microsoft or some other partner, some consultant from the outside to help with that process. Because, you know, for the IT staff to try to do that on their own is very, very difficult.
It's a fair statement. I think it's still difficult.
Mm-hmm.
I think that unless the business people themselves bring in the consultants, if IT brings in consultants and says, look, business guys, we brought you these consultants, it's still IT coming to them.
Yeah.
And in
yeah.
so many companies, IT just doesn't have credibility with the business. It's a shame.
Well, and it's easy to understand after years of failed projects and failing to deliver on promises. They've been burned so many times, they just don't want to do it anymore.
And it's not just that. There's this personality division between mm-hmm. us and them, mm-hmm. right? We're geeks, they're frat boys. Right? We laugh at Star Trek jokes, they laugh at golf jokes.
Yeah, that is there's a big communication gap, certainly, in that. And honestly, well, a lot of us have come up through the trenches of being a developer and looking at the world and through the microscope of development. And, you know, we never contemplated the larger questions about, you know, who's funding this project and who's paying the bills on this? And you know, how does this project help the company realize any kind of competitive advantage? We never thought about that.
My talk this morning began with a story I told about that. I began my working life as a musician. And when I was first being a musician, I played in a band as one of my activities. And I thought I was an artist. I perceived what I was doing as art. And I was disabused of that very quickly. It was clear that really, playing in a band, playing in bars, I was in fact a liquor salesman. And the analogy with developers, I think, is quite real, that we are taught in college and graduate school to be artists. We're taught that what we do is creative, and it is creative. But you get into the real world, and fundamentally, most of the time, we're liquor salesmen. We exist to help people make business processes better, faster, cheaper. There's no shame in that. But I think that embracing that reality is fundamental to being really effective, whether we're talking about an SOA world or any other software project. Now, not to be too negative here, I think we are also artists, just as I and my bar band got some artistry going from time to time. So we certainly do have aspects of art, and I think I embrace and celebrate those. Those are great things. But to a large degree, we exist to make someone else's life better.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned music because I'm also a musician. In fact, my bachelor's degree is in music. So it's funny.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's funny how many people, you know, who are musicians get into the computer business.
Well, you might know there was this odd little band
yeah.
that I was in for a while. We're on hiatus now, it seems. But with Don Box on bass, and
uh-huh.
Ted Pattison playing guitar and singing, Yeah, it's called Band on the Runtime.
I remember that.
We sang dumb songs about .NET.
Yeah, and of course my favorite was Pat Helen doing The Day That IT Died. Did you hear that one?
That's right. I'm the piano player on that.
Are you? Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah.
Don is playing bass, and I'm playing piano. That was at Tech Ed Amsterdam.
That was hilarious. Mm-hmm. Very, very good, yes. Well, so the other really interesting shift, and it's kind of funny to me that Indigo took so much of the oxygen, you know. I mean, there was so much hype about Indigo, which is the code name for Windows Communication Foundation. But later, we began to hear about its little brother, which I think has very profound implications as the Workflow Foundation. I think that has a lot of potential to change the way we think about architecting systems.
I absolutely agree. My keynote this morning was about half on WCF and half on Windows Workflow. Windows Workflow is really important. It is, however, I think a little challenging for people to understand at first blush, primarily because we all have associations with the word workflow, and those associations usually aren't correct for understanding what Windows Workflow Foundation is all about. So, for example, when you hear the word workflow, people tend to think either in a business process sense, where we do this and do that, and then Mary in accounting gets this, it goes to Joe in HR, or we think in the sense of a graphical tool for information workers, where they can define document flows in workflows. And those are both valid meanings of the term. But that is not what workflow means in the context of Windows Workflow Foundation. Instead, this technology defines workflow in a very technical way. You create these things called activities, which are just classes, that are executed one at a time by a workflow engine. And the sequence in which they're executed is defined by the activities themselves. So, this notion of very clearly delineating the flow of your application as a series of activities run by this engine is at the technical heart of understanding what it means to use Windows Workflow Foundation.
Well, you know, the thing that hit me when I first started looking at it was that a lot of the code that you write essentially is doing what this workflow engine would do, right? You're kind of laying out a process, a series of steps you're going to take. You have conditional branching, and you're doing a lot of this sort of stuff. So we've been writing that code for a long time, and I asked the question, well, why would I want to not write that code and describe it in a form that this engine can consume? And at first I was a little skeptical about it, but then when I sat down and did some hands-on labs with it and worked with it a little while, I came to realize there are some very substantial advantages, I think, to allowing this engine to run that code for me.
Yeah, there are. I mean, just the notion of breaking your process into discrete activities, which again are really just classes, is interesting. The engine, for example, can insert tracking automatically, so you can have a runtime record of what's happening inside your process between activities. The engine can also rely on some runtime services that do things like persist your workflow state automatically when there's a delay, such as waiting for a human being to respond to something. There are also graphical tools, which can let you create workflows graphically if you want to, although the technology does not require to use them. You can just write code, too, if you wish. So I think there are a lot of possible benefits of this. At the same time, I don't think every application will be written as a workflow app. You could argue that it should be, because at some level, every app is a workflow in the highest, most abstract sense. But there is some level of overhead and understanding required to use Windows Workflow Foundation. So my guess is that not every app is going to use it. But developers, I think, again, back to our theme of modern applications, to build modern Windows apps, developers ought to understand what Windows Workflow Foundation does, what it's good for, and when they ought to use it.
Well, of course, most people think of the sort of sequential workflow, like a flow chart, you might imagine, right? But I thought, as the more I learned about it, that the part that really excited me was sort of the state-driven workflows, which I think are really interesting, especially as you consider building applications that have to deal with long-running processes and message exchanges that are hard to predict what order they're going to occur in. Building a state-driven workflow seems like a very elegant solution to that.
I agree. It's one of the built-in options in the technology. Or, for example, if you have a workflow where the user, a human being, for instance, can cancel at any step. If cancellation can occur anywhere in a flow chart, then every single node needs to be a branch. If canceled, go this way. If not, go that way. But in a state machine, cancellation is just an event. Mm-hmm. It appears as one event in your state machine. It's much cleaner, much nicer.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's, and so here's the thing I'm thinking about is on the back end of a service-oriented architecture, so if I have a bunch of services that are collaborating together to get some business process done, you know, using that state machine behind the services sounds very interesting to me. Like I could receive a message, and in the message, maybe I've stuffed a cookie in there that tells me the identifier of the workflow that message relates to. So it correlates the message to the workflow. The message, the fact that the message received might cause a state transition in the workflow itself and allow me to respond by, say, doing something on the back-end systems or sending out another message. I think there's a lot of potential there. But the question I have is when do I cross a line between sort of that kind of scenario and into a scenario where I probably ought to be using BizTalk instead?
Yeah, that's a very good question. The model you describe of having some business logic built on a workflow that invokes some number of services using, say, WCF, is paradigmatic of what people call a composite application. It's kind of a blurry term, but that is one of the end goals of being able to create these kinds of composite apps more easily. So we'll see. People are doing that. It might become mainline. It might not. I'm not certain about this myself, but it certainly is one application of workflow, certainly. And yet, you're right. When you start thinking about a workflow-based app that talks to other software, which, by the way, is in no way required. A workflow-based app, most often, I think, will run in its own process like any other app. But if your workflow-based app talks to other software, then at what point does the problem become an integration problem rather than just a workflow application? And I think the answer is when you start to need the services that you get from a product like BizTalk Server. When you need the diverse adapters, for example, that BizTalk provides to speak to IBM MQ series or to speak to the file system or something else. When you need the transformation of schema in messages that you get with BizTalk. When you need, for example, the business-to-business accelerators for standards like Swift or HL7. Or when you need things like business activity monitoring, all of which are in BizTalk, none of which are in Windows Workflow Foundation. As you might know, in the release of BizTalk after the 2006 version, the plan is to replace the orchestration functionality in BizTalk with Windows Workflow. So just that one part of BizTalk. But it's important to understand as well that BizTalk is a whole lot more than just orchestration. And so when you need those other things, that's when your problem stops being a Windows Workflow problem and becomes a BizTalk problem.
But, you know, what's interesting is I find that a lot of people are willing to go to great lengths, create lots and lots of server-side infrastructure because they hesitate to pick up and learn a new server product like BizTalk Server.
It's more fun to build your own stuff. And it can be harder to convince your manager to write a check for a new software product than to spend the time to do it yourself. Yeah, I think those are real issues.
Yeah, and it's a shame because I think it's a the people who have picked up BizTalk Server and use it, and I've talked with them, I find they're really, really happy with the result they got. But it was a leap. You had to take a leap to get there, and once you did, you were happy you did it.
Yeah, in general, that's my experience as well. And the product can be really cheap in some configurations too. People are scared off in some ways by the high price and the complexity of other integration products. Mm-hmm. BizTalk is just different in some ways.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, other integration products, I've seen the price tags of some of those, and they are an astonishing how much money they get out of those. It makes me wonder why we sell BizTalk as cheaply as we do in comparison.
You might have sold more copies if it were more expensive.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
Because people would feel more comfortable buying it.
Yeah, well,
it's a reflection, though, I think, of the value, the real business value that integration has. Because firms like WebMethods make lots of money with relatively high-priced products. They're very successful. They're doing something right. They're providing real value to companies. So there truly is value in these kinds of products.
I think it's in, these sorts of integration problems are the kind of problems that they have to be solved. Mm. You know, there's just like a business comes to a point where you say, we have to solve this. We must spend the money, and we're going to do it. And so hopefully, you know, more and more people will pick this up. And, of course, like you said, you can get a BizTalk Developer Edition very, very cheaply. So you can work with it and learn it and without having to make an enormous price commitment and evaluate it for projects and see if it works for you.
Right.
Well, we are about out of time, but thanks so much for stopping by here on your busy day.
It's my pleasure. Thanks, Ron.
Yeah, and look forward to seeing you at some, I'm sure I'll bump into you somewhere else in the world.
I'm sure we will.
All right.
I look forward to that, too.
Okay, see you.
Thanks.
David Chappell, everyone. David Chappell. Very, very bright, intelligent, just an all-around smart guy. And I love talking to guys like that because I always come away smarter for the experience, as I hope that you do as well when you listen to ArtCast. So tell me what you think. Send me a note to ron.jacobs@microsoft.com. I'd like to know who you'd like to hear from. What kind of interesting person would you like to hear interviewed on this show? And maybe I'll get them on. Who knows? See you next time on ArtCast.